"I spy," said the bursar, "with my little eye, something beginning with H."
"Ooh,
no."
"Horizon?"
said Ponder. "You guessed."
"Of course I guessed. I'm supposed to guess. We've had S for sky, C for cabbage, O for ook, and there's nothing else."
"I'm not going to play any more if you're going to guess." The bursar pulled his hat down over his ears and tried to curl up on the hard seat. "There'll be lots to see in Lancre," said the Arch-Chancellor. "The only piece of flat land they've got up there is in a museum." Ponder said nothing. "Used to spend whole summers up there," said Ridcully. He sighed. "You know, things could have been very different." Ridcully looked around. If you're going to relate an intimate piece of personal history, you want to be sure it's going to be heard. The librarian looked out at the jolting scenery. He was sulking. This had a lot to do with a new bright blue collar around his neck, with the word Pongo on it. Someone was going to suffer for this. The bursar was trying to use his hat like a limpet uses its shell. "There was this girl..." Ponder Stibbons, chosen by a cruel fate to be the only one listening, looked surprised. He was aware that technically even the Arch-Chancellor had been young once. After all, it was just a matter of time. Common sense suggested that wizards didn't flash into existence aged 70 and weighing 19 stone. But common sense needed reminding. He felt he ought to say something.
"Pretty, was she, sir?"
he said.
"No. No, I can't say she was. Striking, that's the word. Tall, hair so blonde it was nearly white, and eyes like gimlets, I tell you."
Ponder tried to work this out.
"You don't mean that dwarf who runs the delicatessen in..."
he began.
"I mean you always got the impression she could see right through you," said Ridcully, slightly more sharply than he'd intended. "And she could run..."
He lapsed into silence again, staring at the newsreels of memory.
"I would have married her, you know," he said.
Ponder said nothing. When you're a cork in someone else's stream of consciousness, all you can do is spin and bob in the eddies.
"What a summer,"
murmured Ridcully.
"Very like this one, really. Crop circles were bursting like raindrops. And well, I was having doubts, you know. Magic didn't seem to be enough. I was a bit lost. I'd have given it all up for her. Every blasted octogram and magic spell. Without a second thought. You know, when they say things like, 'She had a laugh like a mountain stream.'"
"I'm not personally familiar with it," said Ponder, "but I have read... poetry, that..."
"Load of cobbler's poetry," said Ridcully. "I've listened to mountain streams and they just go trickle, trickle, gurgle. And you get them things in them, you know, insect things with little... Anyway, doesn't sound like laughter at all, is my point. Poets always get it wrong. It's like she had lips like cherries, small, round and got a stone in the middle. Ha!"
He shut his eyes. After a while, Ponder said,
"So, what happened, sir?"
"What?"
"The girl you were telling me about?"
"What girl?"
"This girl."
"Oh, that girl. Oh, she turned me down. Said there were things she wanted to do. Said there'd be time enough."
There was another pause.
"What happened then?"
Ponder prompted.
"Happened? What do you think happened? I went off and studied. Term started. Wrote her a lot of letters, but she never answered them. Probably never got them. They probably eat the mail up there. Next year I was studying all summer and never had time to go back. Never did go back. Exams, and so on. Expect she's dead now. Or some fat old granny with a dozen kids. Would have wed her like a shot. Like a shot."
Ridcully scratched his head.
"I just wish I could remember her name."
He stretched out with his feet on the bursar.
"It's funny that," he said. "Can't even remember her name." "She could outrun a horse."
"Kneel and deliver."
The coach rattled to a halt. Ridcully opened an eye.
What's that? He said.
Ponder jerked away from a reverie of lips like mountain streams and looked out of the window.
I think, he said, it's a very small highwayman.
The coachman peered down at the figure in the road. It was hard to see much from this angle because of the short body and the wide hat. It was like looking at a well-dressed mushroom with a feather in it.
I do apologise for this, said the very small highwayman. I find myself a little short.
The coachman sighed and put down the reins. Properly arranged hold-ups by the bandits' guild were one thing, but he was blowed if he was going to be threatened by an outlaw that came up to his waist and didn't even have a crossbow.
You little bastard, he said. I'm going to knock your block off.
He peered closer.
What's that on your back? A hump? Ah, you've noticed the stepladder,
said the low highwayman.
Let me demonstrate.
What's happening? Said Rid Cully back in the coach.
A dwarf has just climbed up a small stepladder and kicked the coachman in the middle of the road, said Ponder.
That's something you don't see every day, said Rid Cully.
He looked happy. Up to now, the journey had been quite uneventful.
Now he's coming towards us.
Oh, good.
The highwayman stepped over the groaning body of the driver and marched towards the door of the coach, dragging his stepladder behind him. He opened the door.
Your money, or, I'm sorry to say, your...
A blast of octarine fire blew his hat off. The dwarf's expression did not change.
I wonder if I might be allowed to rephrase my demands.
Rid Cully looked the elegantly dressed stranger up and down, or rather, down and further down.
You don't look like a dwarf, he said, apart from the height, that is.
Don't look like a dwarf apart from the height?
I mean, the helmet and iron boots department is among those you are lacking in, said Rid Cully.
The dwarf bowed and produced a slip of pasteboard from one grubby but lace-clad sleeve.
My card, he said.
It read, Giamo Casanunda, world's second greatest lover. We never sleep. Finest swordsman, soldier of fortune, outrageous liar, stepladders repaired. Ponder peered over Ridcully's shoulder.
Are you really an outrageous liar?
No.
Why are you trying to rob coaches, then? I'm afraid I was waylaid by bandits.
But it says here, said Ridcully, that you are a finest swordsman.
I was outnumbered.
How many of them were there?
3 million.
Hop in, said Rid Cully.
Casanunda threw his stepladder into the coach and then peered into the gloom.
Is that an ape asleep in there?
Yes.
The librarian opened one eye.
What about the smell?
He won't mind.
Hadn't you better apologise to the coachman?
Said Ponder.
No, but I could kick him again harder if he likes.
And that's the bursar, said Rid Cully, pointing to Exhibit B, who was sleeping the sleep of the near-terminally overdosed on dried frog pills.
Hey, bursar! Bursar!
No, he's out like a light. Just push him under the seat. Can you play Cripple Mr. Onion?
Not very well.
Capital!
Half an hour later, Rid Cully owed the dwarf 8,000 Ankh dollars.
But I put it on my visiting card, Casanunda pointed out. Outrageous liar, right there.
Yes, but I thought you were lying.
Rid Cully sighed, and to Ponder's amazement, produced a bag of coins from some inner recess. They were large coins and looked suspiciously realistic and golden. Casanunda might have been a libidinous soldier of fortune by profession, but he was a dwarf by genetics, and there are some things dwarfs know.
He said, you don't have outrageous liar on your visiting card by any chance?
No, said Rid Cully excitedly.
It's just that I can recognise chocolate money when I see it.
You know, said Ponder, as the coach jolted along a canyon, this reminds me of that famous logical puzzle.
What logical puzzle? Said the Arch-Chancellor.
Well, said Ponder, gratified at the attention, it appears that there was this man, right, who had to choose between going through two doors, apparently, and the guard on one door always told the truth, and the guard on the other door always told a lie. And the thing was, behind one door was certain death, and behind the other door was freedom, and he didn't know which guard was which, and he could only ask them one question, and so what did he ask?
The coach bounced over a pothole. The librarian turned over in his sleep.
"Sounds like psychotic Lord Hargon of Quirm to me," said Ridcully after a while.
"That's right," said Casanunda. "He was a devil for jokes like that. How many students can you get in an Iron Maiden? That kind of thing."
"So this was at his place, then, was it?" said Ridcully.
"What? I don't know," said Ponder.
"Why not? You seem to know all about it."
I don't think it was anywhere. It's a puzzle.
Hang on, said Casanunda. I think I've worked it out. One question, right?
Yes,
said Ponder, relieved.
And he can ask either guard.
Yes.
Oh, right. Well, in that case, he goes up to the smallest guard and says, tell me which is the door to freedom if you don't want to see the colour of your kidneys, and incidentally, I'm walking through it behind you, so if you're trying for the Mr. Clever Award, just remember who's going through it first.
No, no, no.
Sounds logical to me, said Ridcully. Very good thinking.
But you haven't got a weapon.
Yes, I have. I wrested it from the guard while he was considering the question, said Casanunda.
"Clever," said Ridcully. "Now that, Mr. Stibbons, is logical thought. You could learn a lot from this man."
"Dwarf?
Sorry, dwarf. He doesn't go on about parasite universes all the time."
"Parallel!"
snapped Ponder, who had developed a very strong suspicion that Ridcully was getting it wrong on purpose.
Which ones are the parasite ones, then?"
"There aren't any! I mean, there aren't any Arch-Chancellor."
Ponder was 100% wrong about this.
"Parallel universes," I said. "Universes where things didn't happen, like..."
He hesitated.
"Well, you know that girl?"
"What girl?"
"The girl you wanted to marry."
"How did you know that?"
"You were talking about her just after lunch."
"Was I? More fool me. Well, what about her?"
"Well, in a way, you did marry her," said Ponder.
Ridcully shook his head.
"Nope. Pretty certain I didn't. You remember that sort of thing."
"Ah, but not in this universe."
The librarian opened one eye.
"You suggesting I nipped into some other universe to get married?" said Ridcully.
"No, I mean you got married in that universe and not in this universe,"
said Ponder.
"Did I? What, a proper ceremony and everything?"
"Yes."
Ridcully stroked his beard.
"You sure?"
"Certain, Arch-Chancellor."
"My word, I never knew that."
Ponder felt he was getting somewhere.
"So, yes? So, why don't I remember it?"
Ponder had been ready for this.
"Because the you in the other universe is different from the you here," he said. "It was a different you that got married. He's probably settled down somewhere. He's probably a great-granddad by now."
"He never writes. I know that," said Ridcully. "And the bastard never invited me to the wedding."
"Who?"
"Him."
"But he's you, is he?"
"You'd think I'd think of me, wouldn't you? What a bastard."
It wasn't that Ridcully was stupid. Truly stupid wizards have the life expectancy of a glass hammer. He had a quite powerful intellect, but it was powerful like a locomotive, and ran on rails, and was therefore almost impossible to steer. There are indeed such things as parallel universes, although parallel is hardly the right word. Universes swoop and spiral around one another like some mad weaving machine or a squadron of Yossarians with middle ear trouble. And they branch. But, and this is important, not all the time. The universe doesn't much care if you tread on a butterfly. There are plenty more butterflies. Gods might note the fall of a sparrow, but they don't make any effort to catch them. Shoot the dictator and prevent the war? But the dictator is merely the tip of the whole festering boil of social pus from which dictators emerge. Shoot one, and there'll be another one along in a minute. Shoot him too? Why not shoot everyone and invade Poland? In 50 years, 30 years, 10 years' time, the world will be very nearly back on its old course. History always has a great weight of inertia. Almost always. At circle time, when the walls between this and that are thinner, when there are all sorts of strange leakages, then choices are made. Then the universe can be sent careening down a different leg of the well-known trousers of time. But there are also stagnant pools, universes cut off from past and future. They have to steal pasts and futures from other universes. Their only hope is to batten onto dynamic universes as they pass through the fragile period, as remora fish hang on to a passing shark. These are the parasite universes, and when the crop circles burst like raindrops, they have their chance. Lancre Castle was far bigger than it needed to be. It wasn't as if Lancre could have been bigger at one time. Inhospitable mountains crowded it on three sides, and a more or less sheer drop occupied where the fourth side would have been if a sheer drop hadn't been there. As far as anyone knew, the mountains didn't belong to anyone. They were just mountains. The castle rambled everywhere. No one even knew how far the cellars went. These days everyone lived in the turrets and halls near the gate.
I mean, look at the crenellations, said Magrat.
What'n?
The cut-out bits on top of the walls. You could hold off an army here.
That's what a castle's for, innit, Mum?
Magrat sighed.
Can we stop the mum, please? It makes you sound uncertain.
Mum?
I mean, who is there to fight up here? Not even trolls could come over the mountains, and anyone coming up the road is asking for a rock on the head. Besides, you only have to cut down Lancre Bridge.
Dunno, Mum. Kings have got to have castles, I suppose.
Don't you ever wonder about anything, you stupid girl?
What good does that do, Mum?
I called her a stupid girl, thought Magrat. Royalty is rubbing off on me. Oh, well, she said. Where have we got to?
We're going to need 2,000 yards of the blue chintz material with the little white flowers, said Millie.
And we haven't even measured half the windows yet, said Magrat, rolling up the tape measure. She looked down the length of the long gallery. The thing about it, the thing that made it so noticeable, the first thing anyone noticed about it, was that it was very long. It shared certain distinctive traits with the Great Hall and the Deep Dungeons. Its name was a perfectly accurate description. And it would be, as Nanny Ogg would say, a bugger to carpet.
Why? Why a castle in Lancre, she said, mainly to herself, because talking to Millie was like talking to yourself. We've never fought anyone, apart from outside the tavern on a Saturday night.
Couldn't say, I'm sure, Mum, said Millie.
Magrat sighed. Where's the king today?
He's opening Parliament, Mum.
Parliament.
Which had been another of Verence's ideas. He'd tried to introduce Ephebian democracy to Lancre, giving the vote to everyone, or at least everyone who be of good report and who be male and hath 40 years and owneth a house worth more than 3.5 goats a year. Because there's no sense in being stupid about things and giving the vote to people who were poor or criminal or insane or female, who'd only use it irresponsibly. It worked more or less, although the members of Parliament only turned up when they felt like it, and in any case, no one ever wrote anything down, and besides, no one ever disagreed with whatever Verence said because he was king. What's the point of having a king, they thought, if you have to rule yourself? He should do his job, even if he couldn't spell properly. No one was asking him to thatch roofs or milk cows, were they?
I'm bored, Millie. Bored, bored, bored. I'm going for a walk in the gardens.
Shall I fetch Sean with a trumpet?
Not if you want to live.
Not all the gardens had been dug up for agricultural experiments. There was, for example, the herb garden. To Magrat's expert eye, it was a pretty poor herb garden, since it just contained plants that flavoured food. And at that, Mrs. Scorbick's repertoire stopped short at mint and sage. There wasn't a sprig of vervain or yarrow or old man's trousers anywhere in it. And there was the famous maize, or at least it would be a famous maize. Verence had planted it because he'd heard that stately castles should have a maize, and everyone agreed that once the bushes were a bit higher than their current height of about 1 foot, It would indeed be a very famous maze, and people would be able to get lost in it without having to shut their eyes and bend down. Margaret drifted disconsolately along the gravel path, her huge, wide dress leaving a smooth trail. There was a scream from the other side of the hedge, but Margaret recognised the voice. There were certain traditions in Lancre Castle which she had learned.
"Good morning, Hodges Arg," she said.
The castle falconer appeared round the corner, dabbing at his face with a handkerchief. On his other arm, claws gripping like a torture instrument, was a bird. Evil red eyes glared at Magrat over a razor-sharp beak.
"I've got a new hawk," said Hodges Arg proudly. "It's a Lancre crow hawk. They've never been tamed before. I'm taming it. I've already stopped it pecking my... Yarr!"
He flailed the hawk madly against the wall until it let go of his nose. Strictly speaking, Hodges Arg wasn't his real name. On the other hand, on the basis that someone's real name is the name they introduce themselves to you by, he was definitely Hodges Arg. This was because the hawks and falcons in the castle mews were all Lancre birds and therefore naturally possessed of a certain sordu independence of mind. After much patient breeding and training, Hodges Arg had managed to get them to let go of someone's wrist, and now he was working on stopping them viciously attacking the person who had just been holding them, i.e., invariably, Hodges Arg. He was nevertheless a remarkably optimistic and good-natured man who lived for the day when his hawks would be the finest in the world. The hawks lived for the day when they could eat his other ear.
"I can see you're doing very well," said Magrat. "You don't think, do you, that they might respond better to cruelty?"
"Oh, no, miss," said Hodges Arg. "You have to be kind. You have to build up a bond, you see. If they don't trust you, they—"
"I'll just leave you to get on with it, then, shall I?" said Magrat, as feathers filled the air.
Magrat had been gloomily unsurprised to learn that there was a precise class and gender distinction in falconry. Verence, being king, was allowed a gear falcon, whatever the hell that was. Any earls in the vicinity could fly a peregrine, and priests were allowed sparrowhawks. Commoners were just allowed a stick to throw, if it wasn't a big stick. Magrat found herself wondering what Nanny Og would be allowed. A small chicken on a spring, probably. There was no specific falcon for a witch, but as a queen, the Lancre rules of falconry allowed her to fly the Wow Hawk or Lappet-faced Warrior. It was small and short-sighted and preferred to walk everywhere. It fainted at the sight of blood, and about 20 Wow Hawks could kill a pigeon if it was a sick pigeon. She'd spent an hour with one on her wrist. It had wheezed at her, and eventually it had dozed off upside down. But at least Hodges Arg had a job to do. The castle was full of people doing jobs. Everyone had something useful to do except Magrat. She just had to exist. Of course, everyone would talk to her, provided she talked to them first. But she was always interrupting something important, apart from ensuring the royal succession, which Verence had sent off for a book about. She...
"You just keep back there, girl. You don't want to come no further," said a voice.
Magrat bridled.
"Girl, one happens to be very nearly of the royal blood by marriage."
"Maybe, but the bees don't know that," said the voice.
Magrat stopped. She'd stepped out beyond what were the gardens from the point of view of the royal family, and into what were the gardens from the point of view of everyone else, beyond the world of hedges and topiary and herb gardens, and into the world of old sheds, piles of flower pots, compost, and just here, beehives. One of the hives had the lid off. Beside it, in the middle of a brown cloud, smoking his special bee pipe, was Mr. Brooks.
"Oh," she said, "it's you, Mr. Brooks."
Technically, Mr. Brooks was the royal beekeeper, but the relationship was a careful one. For one thing, although most of the staff were called by their last name, Mr. Brooks shared with the cook and the butler the privilege of an honorific. Besides, Mr. Brooks had secret powers. He knew all about honey flows and the mating of queens. He knew about swarms and how to destroy wasps' nests. He got the general respect shown to those like witches and blacksmiths, whose responsibilities are not entirely to the world of the humdrum and everyday, people who in fact know things that others don't about things that others can't fathom. And he was generally found doing something fiddly with the hives, ambling across the kingdom in pursuit of a swarm, or smoking his pipe in his secret shed which smelt of old honey and wasp poison. You didn't offend Mr. Brooks. Not unless you wanted swarms in your privy while he sat cackling in his shed. He carefully replaced the lid on the hive and walked away. A few bees escaped from the gaping holes in his beekeeping veil.
"Afternoon, your ladyship," he conceded. "Hello, Mr. Brooks. What have you been doing?"
Mr. Brooks opened the door of his secret shed and rummaged about inside.
"They're late swarming," said the beekeeper. "I was just checking up on them. Fancy a cup of tea, girl?"
You couldn't stand on ceremony with Mr. Brooks. He treated everyone as an equal, or more often as a slight inferior. It probably came of ruling thousands every day. And at least she could talk to him. Mr. Brooks had always seemed to her as close to a witch as it was possible to be, while still being male. The shed was stuffed full of bits of hive, mysterious torture instruments for extracting honey, old jars, and a small stove on which a grubby teapot steamed next to a huge saucepan. He took her silence for acceptance, and poured out two mugs.
"Is it herbal?" she quavered. "Buggered if I know. It's just brown leaves out of a tin."
Magrat looked uncertainly into a mug which pure tannin was staining brown, but she rallied. One thing you had to do when you were queen, she knew, was put commoners at their ease. She cast around for some easeful question.
"It must be very interesting, being a beekeeper," she said. "Yes, it is. One's often wondered..."
"What?"
"How do you actually milk them?"
The unicorn prowled through the forest. It felt blind and out of place. This wasn't a proper land. The sky was blue, not flaming with all the colours of the aurora. And time was passing. To a creature not born subject to time, it was a sensation not unakin to falling. It could feel its mistress inside its head, too. That was worse even than the passing of time. In short, it was mad. Magrat sat with her mouth open.
"I thought queens were born," she said.
"Oh, no," said Mr. Brooks. "There ain't no such thing as a queen egg. The bees just decides to feed one of them up as a queen. Feeds them royal jelly."
"What happens if they don't?"
"Then it just becomes an ordinary worker, your ladyship," said Brooks, with a suspiciously republican grin. Lucky for it, Magrat thought. "So they have a new queen, and then what happens to the old one?"
"Oh, usually the old girl swarms," said Mr. Brooks, "pushes off and takes some of the colony with her. I must have seen a thousand swarms, me. Never seen a royal swarm, though."
"What's a royal swarm?"
"Can't say for sure. It's in some of the old bee books. A swarm of swarms. It's something to see, they say."
The old beekeeper looked wistful for a moment.
"Course," he went on, righting himself, "the real fun starts if the weather's bad and the old queen can't swarm, right?"
He moved his hand in a sly circular motion.
"What happens then is, the two queens, that's the old queen, right, and the new queen, the two queens start a-stalking one another among the combs, with the rain a-drumming on the roof of the hive, and the business of the hive a-going on all around them."
Mr. Brooks moved his hands graphically, and Magrat leaned forward.
"All among the combs, the drones all humming, and all the time they can see one another, 'cause they can tell, see, and then they spots one another, and..."
"Yes? Yes?" said Magrat, leaning forward.
"Slash! Stab!"
Magrat hit her head on the wall of the hut.
"Can't have more than one queen in a hive," said Mr. Brooks, calmly.
Magrat looked out at the hives. She'd always liked the look of beehives, up until now.
"Many's the time I've found a dead queen in front of the hive after a spell of wet weather," said Mr. Brooks happily. "Can't abide another queen around the place, you know. And it's a right old battle, too. The old queen's more cunning, but the new queen, she's really got everything to fight for."
"Sorry?"
"If she wants to be mated."
"Oh.
But it gets really interesting in the autumn," said Mr. Brooks. "Hive don't need any dead weight in the winter, see, and there's all these drones hanging around not doing anything, so the workers drag all the drones down to the hive entrance, see, and they bite their..."
"Stop! This is horrible," said Magrat. "I thought beekeeping was, well, nice."
"Of course, that's around the time of year when the bees wear out," said Mr. Brooks. "What happens is, see, your basic bee, why, it works till it can't work no more. And you'll see a lot of old workers a-crawling around in front of the hive, because, stop it, honestly, this is too much. I'm queen, you know, almost." "Sorry, miss," said Mr. Brooks. "I thought you wanted to know a bit about beekeeping." "Yes, but not this." Magrat swept out. "Oh, I dunno," said Mr. Brooks. "Does you good to get close to nature." He shook his head cheerfully as she disappeared among the hedges. "Can't have more than one queen in a hive," he said. "Slash, stab." From somewhere in the distance came the scream of Hodges Arg as nature got close to him.